What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, there we go.
We're live. Welcome to Millennial Money, everybody. We got a lot to discuss in today's video. We appreciate you joining us. As always, in this video, we got a little bit of a different format. So our goal is to always do these episodes in person, but obviously I'm in Arizona right now. We can't always do it in person, although that is the goal. So we got a little different format we're going to try today, and we really want to hear from you guys on your opinion on this. If you love it, tell us. If you hate it, tell us. But essentially, we actually prepared some screenshots and whatnot that we're going to go over in the course of this video to kind of keep us on track and talk and discuss and debate a lot of these different subjects, real estate, stocks, cryptos, all that good stuff. So, Graham, Andre, how are you gentlemen doing today?
I would be better if you were in Vegas, Jeremy, so we could film this in person.
The in-person ones are so much better, much better.
Yeah, and they're a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to be in person.
Yeah, so. I think we've all acknowledged the in-person ones are a league different than this. So we are going back to that. And once Jeremy gets back to Vegas where he belongs, then we'll do more of the in-person ones. We want to say a huge shout out to FTX for sponsoring today's video, but we will go into them a little bit later when we talk about crypto and everything they have to offer, but they do help support the channel tremendously. So if you are interested, we do have a link down below in the description. But like I said, we'll talk about them a little later.
Yes.
Yes. And with that being said, Alex, we are ready for the first slide of the rundown here.
What did you prepare for us, Jeremy? You're throwing this at us. Let's see.
We got a lot we're getting into here. We're going to get into the market. Yeah, we're going to even get into NFTs. I even prepped an NFT slide for Andre here today. But where we're starting at here is essentially how far off of all-time highs we already are. And this has happened pretty darn quick. The Dow is now off 8.7%. The S&P 500 is now off over 10%, which now puts it in officially a correction. That is now a correction. QQQ, which is the NASDAQ, is now down 16.3%. IWM, which is the Russell 2000, think of that as small cap stocks, is now down roughly about 19%. So, yeah, we're getting into some pretty big numbers, gentlemen.
What is a crash considered? What percentage? 20. Would you say that was 20 officially?
Or, 20%. Yeah, I would call it crash 20, but technically then we're in a bear market.
Yeah.
Corrections 10%. I don't know. And then then people have different terms if they want to call a collapse like 40%. some arbitrary numbers, but technically corrections 10%, bear market is 20.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And recession is two quarters back to back of negative.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. Yes, yes, yes. So, yeah. Do you guys think this market downward pressure is going to continue on, or you think it's ending anytime soon?
Possibly. I mean, the thing with corrections, though, they're so common. Statistically, they seem to happen every 16 months, give or take. When you have a correction, it doesn't last that long. It could be anywhere from 30 to sometimes 90 days. So if anything, historically and statistically, they tend to be good buying opportunities. But, you know, you never know what's going to happen, really. So I'm just treating this like I'm buying a little bit more. I'm ramping up. Instead of buying, you know, my normal amount, I'm adding an extra like 10%.
Nice. Yeah, it's buy on the sound of cannons and sell on the sound of trumpets. I don't know if you guys want to get into the whole Ukraine thing, but Jeremy, last time we talked about the whole global conflict stuff, we didn't get like too into it, but yeah. I put some numbers for my last video. We could talk about that if you guys want to get into the Ukraine
thing. I know we're going to definitely get into that. That's definitely one of the slides I had prepped. But in terms of the market volatility, I mean, unfortunately, we just have so much crap to deal with in this market. You got inflation fears. You have, you know, the Fed worries. How many times is the Fed going to raise rates? You have this Russia situation that has taken precedence over everything else. You have a lot of things that have gone out of whack, such as real estate prices, which I know we'll get into. And I got some slides prepped for that. And so, yeah, it's a weird market right now. And somebody was bringing up something pretty interesting. They showed Pepsi and Coca-Cola. P ratios, which trade around 25. And then they showed Facebook, which is Meta now, trading at about a 15. And they said, you know, Meta's trading at a 15 on growth concerns when we all know like Meta's going to far outgrow Pepsi and Coca-Cola revenue-wise, net income-wise, everything over the next 5-10 years. And yet Meta's trading underneath those. We're in a funky market.
Jeremy, how sure are you that Meta won't become like the next MySpace in a couple of years? It just seems like social media is so transitory. It's so transient. It's just like it's always constantly evolving and changing. Do you think there's a slight possibility that it might go away of, you know, Facebook or MySpace?
Yeah.
I think that's always a possibility. And that's something Facebook's had to go through since they went public. I remember when they went public, they're like, oh, this could just be the next MySpace. And then a year or two, no one uses it anymore. And that obviously proved to not be the case. And then they own WhatsApp, they own Instagram, and they have so much financial power. They could buy out other things, build other apps. But that's always been a narrative like, oh, it could just go away and no one will use it. And it just hasn't been that way. So you know, I think it's a pretty unrealistic view. It's kind of the same view as like, couldn't everybody just stop drinking Coca-Cola tomorrow? Sure, I guess they could.
Dude, that thing's addicting. The thing's a drug. No one's gonna stop drinking Coca-Cola.
I don't know. I stopped drinking Coca-Cola. Best decision ever. I gave it up entirely when in high school, and now it's stuff is disgusting. But I don't know. I don't believe that Facebook is guaranteed to have more revenue. I think it could be risky. I think their advertising business is definitely under attack. They're going to have to find a way around it. And it's just going to depend on how well they can navigate this. Personally, I think probably they will. Probably they'll do well, realistically. But I don't know. I feel like it's not guaranteed. And there could be anything that happens. And right now, they really don't have the best reputation. I mean, you ask anyone under 35 and no one uses Facebook. A lot of people use WhatsApp. Everybody uses Instagram, but a lot of people are moving over to TikTok. So it'll be interesting to see how they could compete. And they still have not done a good job on long form video content. I tried posting video content to Facebook and even taking my like 12 minute videos and taking them down to like 5 minutes. Horrible. I mean, it's just so bad that after a few months of doing that, like 3-4 times a week.
Do you think that's because the audience there is just a different demographic? It's just like tend to be older. Yeah.
Correct. And Facebook, and I wasn't exactly aware of this, and I'm learning as I go along, but they have a big international reach. It's much bigger in other parts outside of the US. And we tend to forget about that. We kind of think of everything as just being US centric, but for Facebook, a lot of theirs is just overseas. That's where it is. So obviously my US-based financial content is not going to do that well when a lot, you know, a big portion of the population does not reside in the US.
Yeah. And I got to say, I hate soda as well.
What?
Very bad for you. Yeah. No, but anyways, in all seriousness, in regards to that, you know, it's like, who do you want to get in front of? You know, do you want to get in front of, you know, like if you were an advertiser and you're going to advertise, right? And you think about, I want to get in front of TikTok people. Like who are TikTok people? Like what you would think of at least is like high school kids, college kids, maybe something like that. If you want to get in front of a 52-year-old, you might use Facebook, right? Maybe Instagram as well. And I think there's more older people that also use TikTok. I think it's just probably not nearly as popular as some of the older, apps and websites and things like that. But anyways, that's probably way off subject. So nonetheless, we got a lot of volatility in the market. It's probably going to remain volatile. At some point, we'll bottom. That's just do you guys have any sort of prediction on when the market will bottom? It's tough for me to say. I feel like it's within the next 45 days, but that's a tough prediction to make.
I would say it's actually around now.
I think it highly
depends on the Ukraine situation. And that's kind of going into it if you want to get into the numbers. But so just to give you guys some small numbers. So they looked at data between 1926, right, to 2013. And small cap stocks, Jeremy, so the ones you're investing in, the Russell 2000, they actually beat the S&P 500. So they returned an average of 13.8%, but they were also more volatile. So if you could stick through it, you'd make more money if you don't have a heart attack and sell everything. But
that's a good way of putting it, Andre. I have a heart attack and sell.
And large cap stocks, by the way, they averaged a return of 11.4%. So a little bit less, but they also had less volatility. The first world conflict. So the thing I'm talking about, by the way, they kind of broke it up into two types of conflicts. There's short-term conflict and long-term conflict. Now, long-term conflict is like, WAR. I don't know if we're allowed to say it here on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And the short-term conflict is just like an unexpected event, like an attack. Now, the first conflict in 1914, the Dow fell 30%, but that's because they closed the stock market for the entire year. And then when they reopened it in 1915, it went up 88%, which was the highest on record ever. And then between 1939 to 1945, the second world conflict, the Dow Jones index throughout those 6 years was up 50%. So they kind of aggregated all the data, and they say that during long-term conflict, the stock market is less volatile and has better returns. And its lowest point is right before basically the sound of the cannons, right? So it's like that period of time where everything is just a rumor, like, oh, this country is about to attack. That's when it's the worst. And that's why I say the stock market, I think, has probably bottomed if the situation doesn't get worse from this point on.
The issue that I see is that, let's just say that supply chains are interrupted because of Russia, Ukraine. Let's just say that oil continues going up. Oil futures continue going up. That means air travel is more expensive. Shipping is more expensive. Driving cars is more expensive. Vacations, everything is more expensive. And then we get this inflation reading that could be higher that prompts the Federal Reserve to say, oh, wow, prices are rising a little bit faster. We understand there's some tension going on here, but we can't keep having 7.5% inflation. So maybe we got to raise interest rates a little bit more, a little bit faster than expected. That, I think, is the wild card.
So to Graham's point, they did say that during long-term conflict periods, the government is spending more money. So yes, there is more inflation. There is empirical data for that. But they also say that, Graham is right to that point. Yeah, it's definitely going to have some inflation. So.
The craziest one there, Andre, was the year they closed the stock market. Like, that's just nuts.
Dude,
like,
that is nuts. Yeah.
Nowadays.
Okay. So wow. The only counter argument against Graham, what he said, though, is just that the Fed might be a little bit more hesitant to raise rates just because of the instability that we're seeing. So I don't know if you guys agree with that. I know people say that, like, Mr. Papa Powell doesn't care about the stock market, but I do think he pays attention to, kind of like the overall sentiment. So I do think he cares. Yeah. So there is a chance that, like, the only silver lining in this whole situation is that he might hold off on raising rates at, 0.5%. So it might, be 0.25%, but that's the only silver lining.
Yeah, 100%. All right, Alex, let's get on to the second one here. All right. So, guys, this is an interesting one. I had Phoenix, Vegas, and in Dallas taking a picture of here. And it's a highly contested subject, whether we are in a housing bubble right now, if this is not a housing bubble. But when you see, some of these charts, they're definitely a little scary. And anyways, Phoenix, Vegas, and Dallas pretty much the same. I mean, just they've gone up pretty parabolic. And I was looking at almost every single market out there, San Francisco, even LA, everything. It was pretty rough.
I would say that's, I don't know, Graham could comment on this better, but it just seems like such a misleading chart, because it seems like, oh, of course, we're going down, but like times have changed so much. I mean, there's been 10 years, you got to factor inflation, incomes have gone up, inventory has gone down. I don't know. What do you think, Graham?
Yeah, my one complaint with those charts, is that they're two very isolated areas that have seen a huge migration from California and surrounding cities to Phoenix, arguably one of the most now in-demand areas of the entire U.S. It's one of the areas that's seen the most appreciation besides, I think it's Utah and Idaho. Same with Las Vegas. We've seen tremendous movement from people from California and really around the U.S. So those charts, while yes, they do look alarming, they point to such a small segment, I think, of the overall market. I think it would be better to look at the overall Case-Shiller for the entire U.S., and that would give us a better picture, because you could also point to areas like parts of California. I'm blanking on the cities. Like, you know, you do this for Fresno, California, it's going to look totally different. Or, what's another one, like Fullerton? It's going to look different than Phoenix and Vegas, who are, you know, the most. It would be like pointing to, it's a stock that's gone up tremendous. Like, you know, I don't know. Give me a stock that's gone up a lot lately versus Tesla versus
stocks that have gone up lately,
you know, versus another stock that's gone down a lot lately, and comparing the two and saying, well, this is a bubble, but this is not. So that's what I think about that.
That's a great point, Graham. And I will say, in defense of those charts, is almost every single market they showed, I just highlighted those because those are the markets we really care about, but they showed Denver, they showed Boston, they showed a lot of different markets, and they had all pretty much gone up a lot. But I think the main thing to remember for folks in regards to the housing crisis we had, the housing bubble, in comparing to this situation, is don't ever forget how easy it was to get loans. And anybody that was, you know, could get a mortgage back then, like all you had to say was like, I get this, and they give you like some crazy mortgage. Now it is so intensive. Anybody that's been through the home buying process knows how intensive it is, how much they look at the documents, you know, how much you have to provide. I mean, at that time back then, you could put zero money down. You know, now it's pretty customary for 20%. So it's a very different lending market back then than it is today. I will say that.
Jeremy, for real estate, I know you took out equity out of your house, right? Did you already do that?
It's still in the process.
Okay, but you're taking out how much? Like 80%, I'm assuming?
Something around there, 75, 80.
You're going to leave like whatever, 20% to avoid the PMI.
Yeah, and there's more than that. The appraiser was about 600K under what we should have been at. But anyways.
Oh, wait, Jeremy, tell us if what happened here. This is the Vegas house, right?
Yeah, the appraiser came in way low. I don't want to say the specific number on air, but they came in way low. And, you know,
how much
everybody lower? I know that knows a lot about Vegas real estate. It's like, dude, if you put that on the market, it's at least 600 higher than what they appraised it for. And they're like, that would be.
What say what? 600.
600,000. Yeah.
Vegas
house. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's impossible. That's 600,000 would be.
You can't comp in our neighborhood right now because it's so new. It's
why would you say it's 600,000 less? Are you just looking at Zillow numbers or what?
No. Based upon my mortgage lender, who I think knows more about Vegas real estate than anybody I've ever met in my life. So that was his opinion.
But let's just say for a round number, let's just say the home is worth, let's say, throwing it out there, 1.1 million. Mm-hmm. Coming in 600,000 wouldn't make any sense. So they're valuing it as though it's a $500,000 house?
No. Coming in 600K less than what it would sell for today, essentially.
That's what I mean, but that's substantial. The house is worth, would sell for, let's just say, $1 million. 600,000 would be
but it's not $1 million house. I think we all know that.
I know exactly, which makes the 600,000 less even more. I mean, it's one thing to be worth, you know, 2.6 and they appraised for two. Not that big of a deal, but it's a percentage.
I think that's what he's talking about, though. Yes. It is like 2.6 and it's two instead of
Are we talking about the Vegas house? The Vegas,
the main one.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking of your other house that was substantially less. I'm like, that's 50% of the value that.
Yeah. So wait, where were we going with this subject? That went so far off subject. I can't even remember where we started this whole thing.
Oh, we're just talking about real estate being kind of inflated. And
So
I asked you, you took out equity, which you're playing defensive right now. So you're saying that it's better to hold cash than it is to be in kind of in the market.
No, I got that ready just in case we continue to crash this baby. I'd rather have the capital around And so I've done a few things in my life that have, just in case this gets a lot uglier, because the last thing you want to do is, if you are actually get into a crash, be like, let me try to do a cash out refi right now. Good luck doing that. And if you are in a serious crash, or we actually were in some sort of recession. Or
am I crazy to, I'm playing it the exact opposite. I'm like, I'm trying to get as much debt as I can before inflation gets crazy. I'm trying to lock rates as cheaply as possible, because I think inflation is going to continue.
Yeah, that's not a bad strategy at all. Especially if you can lock in low rates. That's the thing. If you think interest rates are going to continue to go up and up and up, you know, it's the smartest thing to do. And I know a lot of people that are in situations with their homes now, where let's say they live in a $600,000 house now that they could sell for $600 tomorrow if they wanted to, but their mortgage is like $800. Because they got such a low interest rate and they bought at such cheaper prices than it is now, which is an interesting thing, a phenomenon for the market, because those people can't move now.
Right.
If they move, where are you going to move to? You know, if you move to another $600,000 house, let's say something equivalent, well, now get ready for your mortgage to pay, be, you know, that would probably be what, $3K on a $600K house, versus you're paying like $800 today or something like that, or $1,000. Maybe $1,200, like, you know, that's crazy to think about. So that kind of hurts the supply situation, where a lot of folks are going to feel like they can't move, because if they do move to get that same amount of lifestyle, they would need to pay so much more in a mortgage and come up with that.
Two things can happen. One, either people don't move and there stays the same amount of demand that keeps prices buoyant, or because they're not moving and because they're not paying these prices, more sellers will come on the market trying to list their houses at the same time, and that will cause values to go down proportionally, depending on how many people refuse to sell or what they're willing to pay for something else. I tend to lean more towards people are not going to sell, they're not going to move, and I think supply chain shortages and just the difficulty with building is probably going to keep prices relatively stable.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, Alex, let's get in the next subject up here. Ooh, okay,
are
gentlemen.
Small caps?
No, these are just stocks in general. Somebody posted this list and kind of went viral out there.
Dude, this looks like the text. This looks like the Dow Jones.
It looks like when the tech bubble happened, doesn't it? I mean, and when you look at this list, here's the thing. This isn't like, this is a bunch of like crap companies.
Sorry. Give us more context. This is over what, the last month?
Over the last year. Okay. So
this is probably got to be from peak.
From
the peak, which a lot of the, I'm looking at a lot of these. We have a lot of meme stocks. We have a lot of Reddit stocks. I mean, like, you know, you look anywhere and you're like, meme stock, Wall Street bets. Like some of these were
oh my bits gosh,
so
Robin
high to begin with. Yeah.
Robin yeah. Some of these are legit, you know, business. If you could put that back up, Alex, cause I would love to go back over that. So look at some of these stocks. They're very legit. You know, you got Square on here. You have PayPal on here, 66% there. You have Beyond Meat. You have Rocket Mortgage, 70%. You have Pinterest, obviously, 73%. You have Affirm, 79%. You have, Wish Stock, 91%. That's a rough one. Sam, which makes Sam Adams beer, and Truly, 71% down. Zoom, 71% down. You know, there's a lot of Fiverr, 78%, you know, these are real companies with real business models. What is that? Redfin, RDFN, 78%. You know, a lot of these are real business models that have substantial revenues and good growth profiles. And they have just been DocuSign down 65%, Twilio, 65%, Matterport, 81%. Stitch Fix, 84%. Some of these moves are crazy.
This is so crazy, man. Because I remember, like, when I first started investing in index funds, I put everything I had, just like $30,000, into an index fund. And in 1 year, I made like $3,000. I was up 10%. The next year, I was down like $1,000. I was down not that much, like 3%. And for the rest of that week, I was so depressed. I was sad. I was angry. I was like, this investing thing sucks. Cause to me, what it felt like was like, I lost a year's worth of progress. Like that's what it feels like. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm looking at my portfolio right now. And you said the S&P 500 is down, what, 10% this year, year to date?
Yep.
10.1
from all time highs.
My stock, my dividend portfolio is actually, you know, it's not doing crazy better, but it's down 7%. It's something, but it's, you know, I can't imagine the people that started investing this year and buying all these tech stocks and all these high flyers and how much money they must have lost. Can you imagine, like, you just invested your first $1,000 and you're down 68, 70, 80%.
But you know what? But that could be that, I think, in the long term is going to get people into index fund investing.
I think so, too.
I think we've all gotten burned with certain stocks like that. We've gone in and we've rode them up to the top and think, oh, this is great. And then they fall. You're like, oh, it'll recover. And it keeps falling. You're like, oh, no. You know, at some point, then you make a decision if that's a risk you're willing to take, or if you're not cut out for it, then you go to index fund investing. Yeah,
that's what I do.
I look at a lot of these stocks and I'm like, a lot of these were stay-at-home plays. They rallied. They went up higher than anybody ever expected. And I won't argue that I pretended like, oh, these were never worth that. Because I remember the moment when Zoom stock went up like 400%. Everybody thought, including myself, I'm like, wow, this could be a major player. And maybe if we stay like this, Zoom is going to take over. I mean, and they could integrate so many different things. And sometimes in the moment you see this and it makes sense.
But everyone was doing that. Everyone was running numbers and profitability, and they were like extrapolating out to the next 5 years. And they were like, if they continue on these numbers, this is going to be $1,000 stock. And I was like, I remember actually 2020, everyone was buying Tesla. Everyone was buying tech stocks. And I was like, man, I don't know. The run up just started and I just stayed away from it all. So I'm kind of glad I did, because I don't have that same kind of nerve wracking experience.
I would be more curious what that chart would look like. And now it's a lot of SPACs in there, so it won't even apply. But what a lot of those companies looked like 2 years ago. So right, like pre-pandemic versus today, how much they're up. I bet it would be a lot more normal looking. I bet, maybe besides PayPal, which just got hit so hard. But I bet a lot of those would seem a lot more reasonable over a two-year time frame. PayPal went from 119 to 103, which isn't as bad of a drop as some of the other ones did.
PayPal's gotten vicious, but you know, a lot of these stocks, if they were public prior to Rona, you know, if you go back to even like 2019, 2018, some of these stocks actually hit levels higher in those years than back then. But let's see, audience poll, are you buying index funds or individual stocks?
Zoom, for example, was 105 2 years ago, and now it's 126. So you would have actually made a profit buying Zoom, you know, assuming obviously it didn't sell at the peak. But
see, and that poll we just did where it was like, what, 65% buy individual stocks versus index funds. I think, you know, for us, you know, that's about right for the numbers for us, because these are people that really care about the financial markets. Like if you're watching this Millennial Money right now, you really give a crap. You're like really in this, right? I think, you know, for most folks, they don't care anything about this. So they just buy index funds, right? But I think those numbers kind of, you know, sound about right. I think if it was my audience, it'd be like, you know, 95% buy individual stocks and maybe 5% mostly index funds. So, and also I think the younger you are, you probably skew a little more toward taking more risk. And I know I've always been like that, you know, versus just kind of the safe route, you know, because if you were going the safe route, you wouldn't even think about touching Bitcoin, right? Right, Andre?
I don't know, man. Are you calling me old for buying index funds?
Speaking of this, by the way, we do have to give a huge shout out to our sponsor, FTX, because if we are going to talk about cryptocurrency, FTX is a fantastic place for you to buy, sell, track, and trade both cryptocurrencies and NFTs all in one place for less than the competition. And they're trusted by over 6 million people worldwide. Not to mention, they also just raised a lot of money. They're U.S. regulated, and it's just an easy-to-use platform. And that's why I've really enjoyed using them throughout the last
year. 4.8 stars on the App Store with 52,000 reviews. That's amazing. You know, if that doesn't say people absolutely love FTX, I don't know what is, because that's amazing.
The other cool thing is... Go for it.
All right. No fixed minimum fees on transactions, no ACH fees on withdrawals, and no fees on top of Ethereum and Solana collections. So they're also the world's most popular cryptocurrency tracking platform. And you can pick from 10,000 different options. So everyone's covered.
Yeah. What I liked is that for every trade over $10, you get free crypto. And so I bought some Bitcoin on the platform the other day, and I got free Dogecoin. Nice. I got one Dogecoin for free, which maybe at some point,
which means Jeremy might eventually someday buy some crypto.
Hey, maybe. I got crypto, man. I got crypto. Right. I just got little crypto. I got little crypto. Okay.
One other thing that I actually thought was kind of interesting is that they just announced a partnership with Coachella, and they're going to be offering a lineup of NFT passes, digital collections, and basically tickets where if you have this NFT, you're going to be able to get like backstage passes and stuff like that, which I think is probably the future of NFTs and how they're going to be used just to verify that like you actually got the ticket that you say you did. You're not trying to copy it. And they got a crypto debit card. So, and that crypto debit card, by the way, is used at millions of merchants worldwide. So if you want to sign up and support the channel, the link is down below in the description. Just click that little link and you won't be disappointed.
Yeah. Nice. Thank you, FTX, for sponsoring. As always, already, Alex, we're ready to get on to the next subject, which might even be crypto related. Yes, it is.
There we go.
Yes, crypto. So, Andre, I'd love to get your perspective. And Graham, you know, with all this drama, you know, in the markets right now, which there's a lot, you know, where does this leave Bitcoin? Where does this leave Ethereum? Like, it kind of seems like both of them are in no man's land right now. And I'd love to get your guys' take. Is that kind of how you view it? They're just in no man's land. They're not really going to go up anytime soon, down anytime soon. What do you guys view as far as that goes?
Well, I wish I could give you some like crazy statistical analysis of the situation, but the reality is just really simple. So anytime the market is scared and it's volatile, it's the riskiest assets like Bitcoin, like Ethereum, like NFTs that track the market, except just worse. Like every move is amplified, right? If the stock market's down 10%, crypto's down 20%. If it's up 10%, it's up 20%. So it just moves with the market. So when this whole thing blows over, then I could see it going up. But I've also seen some analysts talk about like the earliest that Bitcoin could go up in value is the next halving, which should take place in 2024. It doesn't happen right away, the moment of the halving. It happens like within 6 months of it happening. So it could very well be that the next time Bitcoin has this crazy run up, it is in 2024. So in the meantime, it might trade sideways. It might consolidate. It's a good buying opportunity if you want a dollar cost average into it over the meantime. Jeremy, you maybe don't want to buy one like right away, right? But you want to buy maybe $100 a week or $100 a month, just slowly getting into it. I think now is a good time to start accumulating.
Thank you. And I know if I did buy, I would use FTX and I would use our link down in the description area.
There we go. Hey,
by the way, Alex, can you put us to the next slide, please? Because Andre kind of touched on that a little bit.
Stock to flow. Oh, yeah.
No. Yeah. Next Bitcoin bull run won't happen until the end of 2024, says top crypto exchange. Bitcoin may not see a bull market until late 2024 or the beginning of 2025 if past price cycles or any indication, says the co-founder. He told CNBC that Bitcoin bull markets are closely tied to the process of called halving, which occurs every few years. The next halving event takes place in 2024. And he thinks that's could be the next bull market for Bitcoin. So you guys got any opinions?
It's also hard to say because like if sometime in between, which is unlikely, but it could happen if sometime before 2024, we get the spot ETF, right? Then that could kick off the next bull run. But so far, we're kind of at the mercy of macroeconomics. And so far, that's just not looking very good.
What's interesting is if you look at the stock to flow model, right now it indicates that Bitcoin is somewhat undervalued. Mm-hmm. The average stock to flow right now would place Bitcoin at almost 100K, give or take. And now who knows if the stock to flow model is actually going to be accurate and if there's any way to predict Bitcoin's price based on this. I don't know. Part of me kind of thinks it's somewhat similar to like astrology where it's like, yeah, it could kind of make sense, but kind of maybe not.
I think it's more technical analysis, right? It's like it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If everybody knows this model and they see it, that it kind of fulfills itself.
Well, I mean, if it did, then Bitcoin would be at 100,000 because right now the stock to flow as of today, Bitcoin's 37 and the stock to flow pricing puts it at 106. So we should have a 3x upside right now if that is expected.
It should have been if it wasn't for Gary Gensler and not for this macroeconomics, interest rate fears and no spot ETFs. And it should have been.
Yeah, I think it's just it goes to show, you know, because Bitcoin, I don't know if it peaked at, was it 69K or whatever. You know, yeah. we've just gotten into a risk off financial markets where people yeah. don't want to take risk. We, you know, we showed those stocks earlier that are all down 60, 70, 80, 90%. And those are like legit business models. And they just, because no one wants to take risk. And I think that's one of the many reasons that Bitcoin's having so much trouble right now doing anything. And is down significantly from its 52 week highs. It's just like, people are like, eh, you know, do I really have to take risk right now? I don't know. So, yeah. But, oh, nice.
There's the stock to flow model. That
oh, that's literally on. It. Yeah. So it does show us that by 2025, 24-ish would be, according to this, the next run up.
Yeah.
According to this. So we have no way of knowing if that's going to come true or not. I'd like to believe it's true, but I think we all would at this point, to buy in at 30,000 in 5 years from now, it's worth a million.
But that's the beauty of investing in it. You don't have to buy it all right away. You would just dollar cost average into it and you'd be fine.
Yeah. And regardless if you're interested in owning Bitcoin or not, I think it's a must to track. Just for the mere fact that it's going to tell you how much risk is willing to be taken out there in the market. You know, if there's a lot of people want to take risk, Bitcoin's going to do great. And if there's not, it's going to, you know, be tough sledding. So, all right, Alex, we're ready for the next one up here.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, there we go, Andre. I did this one just for you, baby. NFTs ballooned to $41 billion market in 2021 and are catching up to the full size of the global fine art market. Wow.
Wow. That's crazy.
The question is, in regards to this, is how big can this market really be? I mean, are we talking in the trillions? Are we talking in the hundreds of billions? Like, I think that's, up for debate.
Yeah, no, I don't have numbers on what it could be. But interestingly enough, the NFT prices on my end, they're actually somewhat relatively stable. I mean, they're down, but you would think that because of how risky NFTs are, they'd be down substantially more than Bitcoin, and they're actually not. And that's only because the liquidity on them is so hard, it's so low that they don't really trade. And that's why people aren't selling out of everything. It's just because they're not something that constantly trades every single second, every single minute. So people aren't selling them as much. And typically people that hold NFTs usually are not going to be the ones to, like, if you have a $50,000 NFT and the market drops, you're probably not going to need to sell it if you have something that valuable. But yeah, the other stuff, like the 99% of the other stuff, that I could see that, you know, potentially being not worthless. Yeah. Close to being worthless.
The thing that's confusing to me is that they compare NFTs to art. And I think NFTs in the real case are not going to be art. I think art's going to be a component that maybe gets their foot in the door. Like, you're going to buy a JPEG of a gorilla, and that's going to be worth a certain amount. But I think in the big picture, NFTs are going to take place of tickets, are going to take place of ownership. Like, let's say you buy a Ford GT. That new Ford GT comes with an NFT that almost replaces the title. So you could verify that NFT is owned by the person. And maybe that will, I'm just speculating here, maybe that cuts down on car theft because you can't transfer the car without owning the NFT. Same thing with let's say I buy the iPhone and the iPhone comes with an NFT saying I own this specific phone. Could be with anything. So I think, yes, at some point the NFTs will outpace art, but that's just because it's not just art.
That's what NFTs were originally created for. They were supposed to be supply chain verifiers. But there are also expert opinions that are arguing against that approach. And they say that there's really no way to verify anything on the blockchain using NFTs or anything crypto related, because that could be faked. Like you could fake a QR code, you could fake anything. And so, I mean, I'd have to look deeper into it, but there's arguments against that too.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting, if musicians go more the NFT route, because I don't know if you guys saw, this was back in August, actually, a hip-hop artist named Tory Lanez, he sold 1 million copies of his NFT album in like 57 seconds. And I guess they were sold for equivalent of $1 each at that time. So,
I'm curious to see if NFTs will ever integrate into real estate. Like if I want to fractionalize my house and I don't want to sell all of it, but let's say I want to sell 10% of it, would I be able to create some kind of NFT? I guess it wouldn't have to be an NFT. It would just be a token, right? And then I would sell portions of my house and let people invest in it. That way I could still live in it and I still control it, but other people are investing in this specific house because I may not want to invest in Vegas or whatever in Hawaii, but I want to invest in that house specifically because maybe it's a beach house or it's some significant importance. And I think that would be really cool too.
That would be awesome. Imagine if somehow real estate was ever as liquid as stocks, which is never going to happen.
That would be awesome.
Well, I be careful, Andre, because then all of a sudden you're going to see housing prices down 60, 70, 80, 90%. And it's going to be like, short sell that area over there. They're going down.
Imagine buying options on a house.
So interesting. So you guys are saying that liquidity is a huge price function. Is a huge function of the price of real estate. So the reason that real estate is as stable as it is because it is as illiquid as it is. And that's exactly what happened with the NFT. The NFTs are exactly the same reason that why they're stable is because they're so illiquid. It's the exact same story.
Yeah. The good news is with real estate, though, you can't just create a million houses overnight or something like that. NFT market, everybody could create
one. China. They're empty housing projects.
True. All righty, Alex, we're ready for next one up here. Oh, all right. So I thought this was interesting because obviously Russia's in the news right now and this Ukraine situation is dominating headlines around the world. So first off, I wasn't that educated on how much in conflict is going on in that region and has been going on in that region. I didn't even know it was like to that level. So that's pretty crazy. That's a Russian-backed separatist-controlled area, and it's a very, very small area in reference to all of Ukraine. And so I think it's just good for everybody to kind of be educated on, what that is. And I don't know if you guys have any opinion on, is Russia really going to try to go in there? Because I almost feel in terms of like full invasion of Ukraine, because I almost feel like if they wanted to, they would already done it, right? Like it's kind of like you ever seen a fight at school and two kids are acting like they're going to fight and they're like, go do something. You're like, you guys going to fight or what?
But part of that could be trying to get the other person to back down. Like, let's say you are trying to fight. You would want the other person to concede. No, I don't want to do that. Or you could use that to your advantage to negotiate and try to get terms that are favorable to you.
Yes.
And then if that's not working, then what do you do? You'll go forward a little bit, try to spook them. So I think maybe... I'm not exactly familiar with everything, but maybe that could be some of what's going on.
Yeah, that's exactly my theory as well. I feel like, I don't know, I've talked to a couple of Russian people. I actually live in Russia. And their opinion is that it's kind of overblown. And everything we're being told here in the West is very much exaggerated. And I think that's partially true. It's like the whole East versus West narrative. But at the same time, if he invades those regions to give them independence, then that's a serious transgression. But at the same time, to Graham's point, it could just be a bargain, right? A a bargain token, a bargaining token that that Putin is using to get favorable terms for whatever he wants. It's like the equivalent of like, if you want a new job or if you want to get paid more, it's better to come to your boss and be like, hey, I got an offer at this other place for this much. Here's the proof on that. And it's like, okay, there's proof on that. And I feel like he's been wanting to negotiate with the West for a very long time and they've ignored him. Mm-hmm. But it just seems to me like it's something that he wants as any natural leader would want, right? It's like if your country is surrounded by NATO regions and NATO countries, you're like, dude, back off. I want my space here. And so he's just doing what any other country is doing. And I think there's propaganda on both sides. And hopefully people can see through it and not be upset with each other and just kind of like take it easy and not be overreactive on things. And that's just kind of how I'm playing it. I'm just waiting to see what happens. And don't trust every source you read and see. You have to talk to people.
Yeah, 100%. It's it's a tough subject because, you know, if you speak certain ways about it, people are going to view you certain ways, right? Because, you know, I know I've learned, you know, there's certain things we learned in like school, right? Middle school, high school, about like history subjects that were described to us certain ways because the books wrote it that way, right? And then when you got maybe a little older, you did a little more research into it and kind of put the shoes on the other feet and realized, oh my gosh, maybe we weren't as much in the right and ... situation. And, you know, and then you find out how much manipulation goes on behind the scenes and how much sketchy stuff really happens behind the scenes. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh man.
Yeah. It's like that saying, it's like history is written by the victors, right?
So yeah.
It's a little bit of that, I think. And so, yeah, it's hard to say because it's this situation is still affecting markets so heavily, and it's unfortunate, but we just have to get through it. And
does it deserve to be affecting markets? Like, what do you guys think? Does this deserve to be sending the markets down?
Oh, absolutely. I think in any geopolitical tension does, just because of the implications. My understanding is that between Russia and Ukraine, they supply a lot of the materials needed to make chips. And that has the impact of like, okay, well, now if we're not getting semiconductors, well, what does that do to the price of cars, phones, computers, solar panels, everything we use? The other thing to consider is that they import a lot of oil, natural gas, wheat. And it's almost a bit like a domino effect of, well, now if these other countries aren't getting their exports, what does that do to their economy? And how does that eventually spill over into something else, into something else, into something else?
Domino effect, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's like this weird spillover between, you know, alliances. And well, if you do this, then you're siding with this, and that's bad for them. So I do think that to a certain degree, yes, I do think it makes sense why the markets are so affected.
And it's sad because our imaginations run so wild, and it's like, oh, well, then Russia's going to team up with China, and then it's going to create a long-term global conflict that could be even worse, and then it just amplifies everything that much, you know, that much more. But
yeah, 100%. Alrighty, Alex, we're ready for next one up here. The countdown. Oh, yeah. I saw this one today, guys. Refinery explosion threatens to send gasoline prices soaring.
Triple digits is what I'm reading. You guys think that's going to happen? Triple digit oil?
Probably. I wouldn't be surprised. You combine that with the surge demand now that states have lifted their mask mandates. I'm so curious what that impact is going to have for tourism. You know, and how much travel will go on just because they remove the mask. I don't know if that makes a difference or not. I think for some people it will. Some people, they don't care. But I'm curious. I think, you know, maybe that'll lead to slightly more travel right now, especially as travel restrictions ease up. I know a lot of people in Canada will have difficulty traveling. You know, so now that things are opening back up, are they going to? Will that send prices higher? Maybe.
Yeah. Well, do you guys think that the world right now is like the sentiment is that because it seems to me like the market and the world is scared, like it's fearful right now. There's so many catalysts of possibly a recession thanks to interest rates and all this global conflict stuff. Like it just seems like the world is terrified of something, you know, of a recession. People are holding on for dear life with their money.
Well, I can tell you, I went to the mall this weekend, Andre. You know, I was just really curious because, you know, you hear all this fear and whatnot. And so I was like, let me go to an actual physical mall. I know everybody that shops online, you're like, wait, those still exist? Yes, they still exist. Okay. So my wife went to one on Saturday. And that one would be considered more like a middle class, I guess you can say mall. She said it was insanely busy. So then Sunday, I was like, let me go to Scottsdale Fashion Square Mall, which is kind of more like the highest end mall here in Phoenix, essentially, right? So we went there. And I got to say, I've never seen that mall that busy in my life. And that includes during Christmas shopping season. It was ridiculous. I mean, lines at every store to get in, the Louis store, the Gucci store. You know, every store had, you know, long lines at the cash registers. And I'm just like, just insane. Like, and so I've even been fearful of like a recession. And then I go out there and I'm like, yeah, where's the recession at? I don't see it, at least not out here.
It's all the Californians moved to Phoenix.
Maybe. Listen, they brought all that California money, I guess.
those are good anecdotal like points of evidence, but it doesn't support the velocity of money chart, right? Like, so that I think is the biggest, truest indicator of if people are scared or not. And the velocity of money right now is the lowest it's been in like the last 60 years, or let's say, to be fair,
that's a lagging indicator though, Andre. And that's been held back because Rona numbers went so high. So I don't think that accurately reflects what's going on today. What I'm seeing out there in the real world today. I think a lot of the numbers were hurt because in December and January, cases went insane. So
why isn't the Q1 2022 there? I guess we're not through Q1 2022 yet.
I believe it or not, I think
inflection is going to be higher. You think it's going to go way up after this?
I think it's going to go up. I think for the first time in a long time, we're going to see an actual uptrend here. Okay. You know,
so do you think that people that are shopping typically in malls, are they the, I guess, representative of like the investor class?
What do you mean by that exactly?
As far as just like, you know, stocks and invest, like, you know, asset buying. Is that
I think it depends. I mean, I think, you know, everybody's invested for the most part in some way, maybe not in individual stocks, but maybe in index funds, real estate, something.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't know why this just hit me. I was at this mall and there was a Bitcoin ATM, Andre, and two younger kids walked by. They were probably about 19 years old and they go, oh, finally they got one of those here. They didn't use it, but they just thought it was cool.
I've never understood those. Those are such a ripoff.
Who ever uses them? I mean, I never understood it. I never understood the point. I thought it was very gimmicky. I've never seen anyone use it. Like every time I've seen a machine, never once has there been someone actually like using the thing.
Yeah. But surprisingly, they're a big moneymaker for the operators. And I agree. I've never seen people use them, but I think, you know what I think the draw is? I think under a certain dollar amount, there's no KYC required.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. By the way, back to the gas prices, because I know we probably went way off subject there, but you know, with these gas prices going up the way they are, man, you want to talk about just another thing to push people toward thinking about their next vehicle being an electric vehicle. This is it. When you start seeing, you know, gas prices continue to go up and up, and we're in February right now, guys. I mean, if this continues on, imagine where gas prices are usually always the most expensive in summertime. I mean, could we be looking at $4, $5, $6 gas, you know, per gallon? I think a lot of people start seeing those numbers and are like, I think my next vehicle is going to be an EV after all.
No, California, it's already $5. You go to most parts of West LA, you see like $5.36. It's insane. Yeah. It depends on the gas.
I don't think people are going to be like, let me go buy a Tesla now. Like, I don't think that's the alternative.
Well, the thought process is, you know, like, let me consider getting an EV for my next car. Cause you see these gas prices, right? And usually if anything bad happens to you, you kind of are in this moment of like, how do I fix this? Right. And one of the ways you can fix it is potentially getting an EV as your next car. Right. So I don't think it's like everybody goes out and buys EVs cause gas prices go up. I think it's just like that thought that hits your head where you're like, dang, it would be sweet to have an EV where I could just charge at my house for way cheaper than this $5 a gallon gas or whatever. So, yeah. And what we have all seen. Oh, go ahead, Andre.
What's a cheap, like, practical electric car that's not as crazy expensive as Tesla?
Well, I think I think a Model 3. A Model 3 is about the cheapest real EV.
Like 60 grand. That's not a normal car.
No, like you can get it for 40. You can get it for 40 something. Yeah.
Chevy Bolt.
That's 40 is not normal. That's not a normal car.
Andre,
price.
I've been educated on how expensive all vehicles are now. Andre, go to a dealership.
I'm not arguing with that. I'm just saying a Tesla Model 3 is not a practically non-pricey vehicle. It's very expensive.
Yeah, but I'm telling you, the days of I'm going to go get a $15,000 car, $20,000 car, those days are long gone. You go to your dealership, dude, we're talking everything on the lot's 50, 60, 70, 80 grand. I heard something about the new Silverado EV is going to be 100K plus or some crazy number.
You know what's crazy? I saw an article today that Toyota RAV4 is almost $100,000for a Toyota RAV4.
Yeah.
What?
Yes. Dude, this is the craziest crap. I was really contemplating this weekend, Andre. This is the craziest thing. Tesla's going to go from being the most expensive car and Teslas are so expensive, to they're going to end up becoming the cheap ones on the block, which is going to just expand their market share rapidly. Yeah, because literally you can get a Model Y for what, 50 grand or whatever. Go try to buy an ICE SUV. And
am I taking crazy pills to think like a $50,000 car is not a typically affordable car for most people?
Yeah, until you realize what new cars cost, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh wow, Tesla's not even
that expensive. So Andre, I agree with both. I mean, it's like, yes, I do agree with you, but also yes, Jeremy is right. You go to these car lots, everything is selling like $10,000 over MSRP.
I'm not arguing that point. This is true, but you could still get a Toyota or a Honda for like 20 grand, 22. Yes. 24. Correct. Yeah, like that's it's not that
bad. It's not new.
I mean, that's fine, but I would rather buy a $20,000 Honda or Toyota than a $40,000 Tesla. That's ridiculous. That should not be your second option.
Yeah.
You guys are just like ultra rich. You guys forgot what it's like to make 50K a year.
No, we're just bringing up a point, Andre. You're trying to make an argument here about
Tesla. I'm not arguing with your point that cars are getting expensive. That's not my argument.
Yeah, that's fair play. But don't say we don't know, you know, what it's like to make 50K, because I'm just bringing up the point that Tesla in the market is no longer as expensive as it seems when you compare them to what ICE vehicles are selling for now. And never mind EVs. Dude, these EVs are going to be so expensive coming from these other players.
Yeah, if you're comparing apples to apples for EV, yeah, I'm sure they're not like crazy, but still, I think they're crazy if you're comparing just getting a car, period, just to get around. Like if I was in that situation, I would never be paying $5 gas and be like, well, you think I'm going to get a $40,000 Tesla now? Like I would never do that. I would drive a beater car that's cost $2,000-$3,000 if I get my hands on
it. I'll tell you what's going to happen. People are just going to drive less, and they're going to be more strategic about where they drive.
Yeah.
That's what I think realistically is probably going to happen.
I bought a 49cc moped for $600, and it cost me $1 to fill up. It got me like 70 miles to the gallon. Yeah. Nice. That's when everything was affordable back then.
Yeah, the mom with two kids that drives a Tahoe or a Suburban right now is not really considering getting the moped, Andre. She's going to consider getting the
$40,000 Tesla. Okay? Yes, sure. Sounds reasonable.
That's who I'm talking about. That the people that
pump
have
it, Jeremy, pump it. Pump
well,
the
it's
stock.
Not just them. There's a lot of other EVs out there. It's. I mean, Chevy's got products coming to market. Ford's going to have
the Nissan Leaf. Yeah, the Nissan Leaf's actually relatively affordable. It doesn't get you very far, but that's an affordable one.
Might get you around the neighborhood, and then you have to plug it in.
Yeah.
No, but in all seriousness, I think it's a exciting time for EVs. But we'll see. Hopefully, gas prices don't go too insane, because at the end of the day, that just takes more necessity money out of people's pockets. Regardless, if you're middle class, if you're not middle class, it's just less money you have to spend on other things out there. So, and it affects the transportation with all the think about truckers and all the fuel they use. Oh my gosh, it's crazy.
You guys remember the whole thing that Elon tweeted at Trudeau about something? I mean, I don't want to repeat it, but he was calling Trudeau out for. Do you guys remember what happened? That was like a ban on something to do with truckers, but I don't recall.
Oh,
what
the
it was.
Banks. Weren't they freezing? They were freezing bank accounts for people who donated to the movement, right?
Is that what it was? Yeah, it was like a protest of some sort.
Correct.
Yeah, that's a dramatic situation. I haven't been keeping up with it super, but I know it's a very controversial topic, so yeah. I'm not even going to try to touch on that one. That's more controversial than Russia-Ukraine situation from what I've heard. So that's a... But anyway, Alex, we're ready for the next one up there. Oh, you got. I saw this and I was like, you guys are going to love this one, especially you, Graham. His mother promised him $1,800 when he turned 18 if he stayed off social media for 6 years.
Wow. What's the opportunity cost, though, of that, though? Come 100%. On. I think that's terrible.
Yep.
What, $1,800 for what? Not to keep touch with your friends? It's not to stay up to date with employers? Imagine he works for a company and they're like, hey, we need you to help us on Instagram. He's like, what's Instagram? What's TikTok? I think it's a terrible deal. I'll never take that.
Yeah.
Well, you guys got a more positive probably feeling of social media than a lot of people do.
$300 a year. She's paying him 82 cents a day. Meanwhile, people could make $1,800 a day by posting on social media. I think it just depends how you use it. I mean, I am both a consumer and a creator on social media, but I don't spend all day browsing Instagram. If I'm on Instagram, it's usually for business. It's like I'm on there keeping in touch with people who, you know, eventually we work together or friends. But terrible deal. I'm not a fan of that.
Wow.
I think he got ripped off.
When
she made him the deal, imagine how much $1,800 was worth 6 years ago. And now he gets paid $1,800. That's like the equivalent of like $900 with inflation.
But think about it this way, Graham. One, he wasn't going to make any money off social media because 99.9% of people don't make any money off social media.
So that wasn't happening.
That's true. But also, he didn't have to read, your hair looks messed up in this photo, and it didn't have to ruin his day. So
yeah, or maybe say someone says, hey, your hairline is awesome. You have a great smile. And, what are you doing next week? You know, you
could get no one's ever said that, ever, Graham, ever. That's never happened in social media.
You gotta get some headshots, Jeremy. Gotta get some professional pictures done.
I wish everybody was nice like that on social media, but
Jeremy's like, I've never had that.
Jeremy posts pictures of the frozen food section versus pictures of himself. So Jeremy, I would implore you, post pictures of yourself. Post pictures of you and your family, your kids doing fun stuff.
Man, but I think people like to see the freezers, man. The freezer aisle. That's what people really want to see. So, oh gosh. Well, anyways, yeah, I think it really comes down to you as a parent and, you have a kid and do you want them on social media or not? And I think it's, as a parent and, my oldest now is 7. So, a few more years go by and next thing you know, he's going to probably end up having a smartphone eventually. Oh, and then,
Jeremy. Yeah. That was my question to you. So it's interesting. My point of view is exactly the same as Graham's. It's like being on social media makes you extremely competitive and being aware and having the skill sets to go in the future. But it also comes at a cost, at a mental cost, at mental health cost. So at what point in your kid's age would you give them access to social media?
That's I got to figure that out. I mean, I haven't even decided on smartphone yet. First, ooh. I'm like, when do they get an iPhone? I'm like, is that 12 years old? Is that 14 years old? Is it?
Do you think it's bad parenting then to give access to your kids at maybe like the age of 9 or something like, and maybe they learn how to code and they learn how to do software development? Because I have a friend who has a kid, and he's like 7, and he's like genius level smart with technology. And it's cool because it gives them such a huge leg up, but I'm sure it also comes at some, or at least it will come at some, cost. So I don't know.
I know.
I think it's the point where it's holding your child back from everyone else at school. When everyone else is doing it and your child is a bit more of an outcast because they're not participating in the events that all of the other kids are doing. That's when but again, I'm not a parent. So I'm just like, I'm talking nonsense here because I have no skin in the game.
Graham, you have literally only a money making mind, and that's brilliant, man. I love it.
But I'm like, get my kid on social media as soon as possible. He's going to be Graham's the first one on it.
Monetize my child.
Yeah, he's going to get more. He or she's going to get more followers than all the other kids. We're going to boost up his numbers. We're going to post content for the algorithm. We're going to get the right hashtags on this, and we're going to get sponsors. So third grade comes around, this kid's making $1,000 a post.
Hey, the Kardashians are watching the show right now, and they're like, man, Graham is spitting tonight. He is spitting Chris Jenner. Yeah. Chris Jenner is like, yo, go, go. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a tough decision at the end of the day, you know, because I remember when I was a kid, we had one family computer to the internet, right? And it was like out in the open and like, you know, if your parents could easily walk by and see what you're doing. Now you don't know what your kid's looking at or what they're doing if they got a smartphone. That's the tough part, is it's like, what are they getting into? What activities are they doing or not doing? Oh,
man. You were downloading something and your mom picked up the phone and you're like, duh, you interrupted 3 hours worth of downloading progress.
Yes. Oh my gosh. You shut the internet off, mom. Why would you do that? all right, Alex, what else we got tonight? Oh, SoFi thought this was interesting.
Oh,
45% down in 3 months. SoFi, any interest there, gentlemen, or what is going on with SoFi?
I bought 100 shares today just for fun.
No way, you did?
100, I mean, $1,000. You know, in the big picture, it's such a small amount, but listen, I think $10 for $1,000 in proportion to everything else, I don't mind. I don't mind taking a nibble here and there. It doesn't matter to me.
Graham, didn't you buy SoFi a couple months back or no?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. So I've staggered in. I basically dollar cost averaged into SoFi. I think my cost basis right now is probably $12 to $13.50. I don't know.
That's not bad. Yeah.
It's definitely higher than where it is now, but it's not like the $20 when it was at its peak.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I just occasionally, if I feel like it, I'll buy a little bit of it.
That's crazy coincidence that I happened to bring up this specific stock on a day when you bought it. I mean, it makes me think it'd be a shame if somebody had hacked your internet. Andre, what do you think about SoFi?
I like it. I just wanted to ask, is the financial sector particularly down right now?
It's fintech, man. I mean, because you looked at, you know, we talked about Square earlier, down 66% or 67, whatever. PayPal, Robinhood. Yeah. It seems like it doesn't matter what you're doing in fintech right now. You can't do anything right. Anything.
Right. And that's just the whole interest rate narrative.
Yeah. I think it's more than that. And you know, I brought this up to Graham a long time ago. You might not remember, but we were talking about fintech valuations in like the private market and whatnot. I think it was one day we were at the gym and I was like, man, I feel like fintech is such a bubble right now. And, you know, the problem is with all these companies, they had a big boom cycle with new people signing up for their products, right? I don't care if you're talking stock brokerages or something like SoFi or whatever, right? Crypto brokerages. It was such a boom because everybody had so much time in their hands. They were watching YouTube, watching all the social media stuff. And they're like, hey, man, yeah, let me get into this. They set up accounts. And then assets under management went way up. And then now they're kind of stuck in the situation where it's getting harder to acquire customers.
It's all price action, though. If prices are going up for everything, then, you know, I hear all my friends are making money. And it's like, oh, my gosh, how do I make money? Oh, watch this YouTuber. That's how I learned.
Yeah.
And it's like a snowball effect. So it makes sense. When prices are going up, everyone's making money. Everyone's spending money. Now it's the exact opposite.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Now there's no one talking about anything. You don't want to talk about your investments right now, because if you bought SoFi 5 days ago, you're already down 14.5%. And no one talks about that, right? So,
I love actually sharing my like losses and even especially when it's losing money. Because I think you can't always show people when you're making money.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not relatable. It's not always going to happen. And it's nice to be able to say, hey, I'm down like everyone else too. And I'm still invested and everything is fine.
Yeah. It's tough, you know, because most people don't have platforms, right? So most people, if they're telling somebody about a loss, they're telling friends or family members, right? Right. And the toughest thing about that is then you're like, well, they're going to look down on me more than likely, right? They're going to be like, what are you doing? You're losing money in some stocks and stuff. They're going to look down on you. They're not going to understand it. And they might be fearful for you. So like, hey, you know, you need to be safe. Like, get out of those stocks, get out of that crypto, whatever. You need to put your money in a bank account or an index fund or whatever. So,
yeah, I feel like it encourages, like, if you're honest and transparent with your losses, I think it encourages that conversation to explain to friends and family, like, hey, I know I'm down, but you know, it's okay, because over time, here's what happens to the market. I think it's encouraging to openly talk about losses rather than like hiding them and being like, oh, I'm not, I'm not smart. I wasn't making money. It's like, it's all right. That's just what happens to the market.
The problem is, I think you have to really get the person that's really open to the idea. Because I remember at Quick Trip, I would try to get so many people into investing and into the stock market and what I was doing. And it was like talking to a brick wall most of the time. They're just not interested, right? They have to be open to it. And if they're not open to it, it's just
This is where I think dividend stocks especially shine to me. Is like, you could say like, hey, I know the principal value is down, but look, I'm still being paid. I'm still being paid out. And that's the beauty of that. Like, even if you're losing money, you're still collecting that cash flow. And I think I love that strategy.
Yeah, I think dividend stocks are probably the best to get people into the market for that exact reason. And usually they're considered safer companies. So yeah. All right, Alex, what we got left? Overtime or anything else? Overtime, we got anything we didn't discuss in this video that you guys thought we should have discussed today?
Overtime. Hmm. Well, we got the yield curve, which is beginning to flatten. And that's from the expectation of rising interest rates and inflation. And that's supposed to be predicting a recession. That recession could happen in, usually it's about a year, give or take. So again, an indicator that people look at. It's not 100% accurate. It's pretty accurate, but it's not 100%.
And don't scare people, Graham. It's not inverted yet.
God. But the other thing, Andre, I think you mentioned in one of your videos that even during recessions, it's not guaranteed. Stocks aren't guaranteed to go down during a recession.
Yeah, it's 50-50.
Yeah. So even though you hear the term recession, it sounds bad. But I think most people confuse recession with a bear market. They think, oh, we're in a recession. Stocks must be down 20%. But the recession versus a bear market, two totally different things. We could have a bear market without a recession. We could have a recession without a bear market.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes they're not correlated. Look at the Russell recently hit bear market. We got S&P 500 in a correction. And like I said, you know, I go to the malls, look at real estate, look at almost everything in the underlying economy. I think it's doing really, really well right now. But the stock market's not doing well. So crypto's not doing well.
If you guys could take out a loan of $1 million, a small loan of $1 million at a low interest rate, would you do it?
Yeah, I would. I mean, depends how low. Under 3%, yes.
Under 3%.
Three and a half, I'd probably say yes at 3.5. 4, I would turn it down, most likely. Okay. Just because under 4, I would strongly consider it.
I agree.
Fixed for 30 years, though. It had to be fixed for 30 years.
Okay.
I would do it as well, and then I would put margin on top of that and go all in call options. No, I'm just kidding.
All right, let's wrap it up.
I'll get a loan on the loan and then,
package it and sell it as a CDO. Great. Love
it. There we go. Next thing you know, I'll have $100 million in the market. Oh, gosh. Well, this was a fun episode, guys. Hey, everybody in the comments, let us know how you enjoyed an episode like this, or if you didn't enjoy it. I know we try to stay more on track and with slides and whatnot. Let us know in the comment section. Did you like this? Did you not like it? We're indifferent about it, so we're always willing to try things and adapt and whatnot. We love to hear from you guys as always. We appreciate you. Thanks for smashing. Don't forget to use FTX, which is linked in the description area. Make sure to subscribe to the channel. And until then, we'll see you guys next week. Stay tuned with Millennial Money Clips and make sure you follow us all. And links are in the description for that.
Good night. Sounds good, guys. Pretty soon we'll do the pre-recorded videos. So yes. As soon as you come back, Jeremy, I'm ready when you are.
With Chime Secure Credit Card, you can start improving your credit scores with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments. Get started at chime.com/build. The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Results may vary. See chime.com for details. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.